Welcome to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on foreign policy under President Trump, with special attention to the U.S.-Korea relationship. We'll be hearing first from Wendy Sherman, former Undersecretary of State. She led negotiations on the Iran nuclear weapons deal, and in a previous administration, the Clinton administration, she focused on North Korea. And now to my conversation with Wendy Sherman. The president has announced his decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and even to move our embassy there. Is he shaking things up in a useful way, or is he burning things down?
Well, I think it remains to be seen a little bit. But quite frankly, my greatest concern about the president's announcement last week was that he did it really in a vacuum. It wasn't part of some broader strategy. There wasn't a really good setup with our allies and partners around the world. He really, as he has done on many things in national security foreign policy, gone it alone. And when you do that, you may make a couple of people pretty happy, as of course he certainly did Prime Minister Netanyahu in the State of Israel. But you make a lot of people quite unhappy, not only the Palestinians and the broader Middle East, but our European allies and partners as well, who don't quite know what we're doing or why. So there was no context. There was no real preparation. It doesn't look like it's part of a broader strategy. And beyond that, we put all of our personnel and American citizens at risk, not only in the Middle East, but in every Muslim-majority country in the world. And quite frankly, my understanding is there wasn't much preparation other than one cable that went out that said, be careful.
Yeah. Now, King Abdullah of Jordan said that the status of Jerusalem is really central to any Middle East peace agreement. Is this move, will it have the effect of undermining any chance of reaching that big deal that that President Trump has been promising in the Middle East?
Well, it may well have aborted any effort by the Trump administration to try to reach Middle East peace. It indeed, as you said, Jane, for decades, it has been so that Jerusalem is what's considered a final status issue. That means it would be decided by the parties themselves, maybe with the help of the United States and other partners, but it would really be a final status issue because it is so fraught with so much history, so many politics. Mm-hmm. There's no question that Israelis believe that Jerusalem is their capital. And there is no doubt that Palestinians believe that East Jerusalem is their capital. So everyone has known this is a very fraught and complicated and difficult issue. It's not that there aren't solutions. There probably are, but they are all tough. And Saudi Arabia sees itself as the keeper of the holy sites, not only at Mecca and Medina, but the Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem.
So actually, let's move to Saudi Arabia with this conversation, because we're in the midst of another struggle as well, and that's the struggle, the competition between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And we've very clearly put a stake in the ground that we weigh in on the Saudis' side. And I think where you see this most dramatically is when it comes to the proxy war in Yemen. And there, of course, we're facing a real humanitarian catastrophe right now. But the decision both to support the Saudi-led coalition, but also to play a role in Yemen, that was a decision first taken in the Obama administration and then in many ways kind of stepped up pretty dramatically in the Trump administration. What were the considerations then, and where do our interests lie?
Well, I think we have all wanted the countries in the region to take more responsibility for the security in the region and not just rely on the United States. And so it is true that the Obama administration encouraged the Saudis, the Emiratis, to play a role. Certainly, we wanted them to be part of the coalition for the effort in Syria against the brutal dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad. But what we have seen over the many months that this war has gone on in Yemen is that Saudi Arabia has taken a very aggressive stance. There doesn't appear to be an end in sight. The Iranians, who did provide some support to the Houthis, which were a minority, small 10% of the population at the beginning of all of this, had provided some support. But the Houthis really got this initiated on their own. But it has now, as you say, become a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And last week, we saw two very dramatic changes. First, Saleh, who had headed the government, brutally, many believed, for decades in Yemen, been replaced by Hadi as part of the GCC's plan for getting to a better place for Yemen before this war broke out. Saleh, who had been with the Houthis, decided he would try to create some reconciliation in his country. As a result of that decision, he was killed by the Houthis. And that has really stoked this sectarianship even more. But on the plus side, and to your point about the devastating famine, cholera epidemic that is facing Yemen, the Trump administration called for Saudi Arabia to provide more humanitarian access. They had closed down all of the borders, all of the ways into Yemen. They had opened up a little of them, but the Trump administration last week called for Saudi Arabia to do more. This is a positive thing because we're talking about many, many, many people, quite frankly, the worst famine that we have seen in the world in some time.
Now, the president has been, Iran has been kind of front and center for him when it comes to that region, almost an obsession. This has been a big issue for him. You were part of, in fact, you led the effort to negotiate the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Well, first of all, to say a word about its arms control benefits, and then I want to ask you about a more political question, and that's whether there's intrinsic value in negotiating with the moderates and in that way buttressing them. And if there's anything to my thought there, what is the political impact of putting that agreement at risk, political within Iran?
Sure. So first of all, both Democrats and Republicans believed that Iran should not be able to obtain a nuclear weapon. On that objective, there was complete bipartisan support. President Obama believed that the best way to do that was through diplomacy, backed up by a credible threat of force, but with diplomacy at the center. There were some who believed that we should have used force. And in fact, President Obama had even commissioned and deployed a weapon that could have struck out the once underground enrichment facility known as Fordo. So we had the military means, but President Obama understood that you can't bomb away knowledge. The Iranians knew how to do what they knew how to do. They had mastered the entire nuclear fuel cycle. So if we had bombed the facilities, they could have recreated them within 2 or 3 years, probably would have done it in secret and underground. And bombing might also have set off an Arab-Persian war, which would have consequences none of us could have imagined up front. So war was not, in his view, or in mine for that matter, the best option. Some people believe we should just continue what were very effective sanctions. Really hurt the Iranian economy. But we had a lot of people around the world helping with those sanctions because we were engaged in diplomacy. And they saw it as useful pressure to get Iran to the table, but not as an end in themselves. And quite frankly, when the Europeans began in the early 2000s to negotiate with Iran, Iran had 164 centrifuges. By the time we got to very serious negotiations after President Rouhani was elected in Iran, which we'll get to the second part of your question, in 2013, even with the very, very, very effective sanctions, Iran had 19,000 centrifuges. So sanctions don't stop bad behavior. They just say to someone, you want to get to this negotiating table because you're not going to solve the problem these sanctions have created unless you do.
Right. So they're leveraged just to get
leveraged.
To the table.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So President Rouhani was elected in August of 2013 on the basis of trying to improve the Iranian economy. Most of the majority of the population in Iran is under the age of 30. Even though there's censorship, they all have cell phones. They see what happens in the world. And Rouhani understood that if he didn't do something to improve the economy, that there might be another green revolution, as had been tried in 2009. And this time it might be successful and pretty tough on the mullahs. So Rouhani got very serious about the negotiations. President Obama got very serious about the negotiations. And in a process that took almost 2 years, even though there had been negotiations going on for quite some time, we got to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Now, to whether this helps, you know, I think that there are what we tend to call moderates, but I call the hardliners in Iran, as opposed to the hardliners in Iran, which are the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Quds Force, even the intelligence services. So we're not talking, when we talk moderates in Iran, about who we consider moderates in the West. But nonetheless, they are more of a reformer than the most conservative clerics, though President Rouhani is a pretty conservative cleric, so we shouldn't have any illusions here. But it does help to buttress him. He is trying to get hold of the economy. He is trying to open up his society some. He's trying to get some control over the IRGC's budget. When the sanctions were on, the IRGC really came to own a great deal of the Iranian economy. They cornered the black market during the time of sanctions, and Rouhani's trying to claw some of that back. And that's important because we don't want the IRGC to be able to act with complete impunity in the Middle East, which is currently what's occurring.
Well, of course, that's what President Trump is focused on. He's focused on the sort of their support of terrorism, their kind of stirring the pot in many places. Mm-hmm. And it's not really so much the nuclear program, because in that sense, the agreement, well, the agreement in its own terms and for its own purposes is serving those purposes.
Yes.
So he's talking about something that wasn't a part of the negotiation of the agreement. It's a separate issue.
Indeed. And President Trump would say that the agreement is not good because it didn't deal with all of these things.
Yeah, yeah.
And it should have dealt with all these issues. Well, the agreement is 159 pages long, and we wouldn't have had one. And did we really want to trade off ensuring that Iran wouldn't obtain a nuclear weapon with all these other things? It would have made this a bottom feeder agreement, not a high-level, high-threshold agreement. And quite frankly, as bad as what Iran is doing in the Middle East is today, it would have been horrific had they had a nuclear weapon, because they would have been able to project even more power into the region and deterred our allies and partners' actions.
Yep.
So, yes, we need to deal with what Iran is doing in the region, but ripping up the nuclear deal and allowing Iran to get back on the road to a nuclear weapon doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right. Getting rid of the thing that works.
Exactly.
In order to,
exactly.
to deal with the things that don't. You know, this, tell us first just a word about the agreement itself. In essence, it means that for 10 years, they can't make any progress on nuclear weapons. And
it's actually for much longer than 10 years.
So,
according to the agreement, Iran can never obtain a nuclear weapon. The years that people talk about are the years that certain limitations come off. So there are very, very strict limitations for 10 years. But for 15 years, Iran has to keep its stockpile at 300 kilograms of enriched uranium and can only enrich to 3.67%. You can't make a nuclear weapon at that level. For 20 years, we have the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which does all the monitoring and verification, has eyes on all the development of centrifuge technology. For 25 years, the IAEA has what's called uranium accountancy, which means from the time the uranium comes out of the ground, as it goes through the whole process, they watch it.
Yeah.
So they know there can't be a covert supply chain. And then forever, Iran is committed to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and the additional protocol, which has eyes on everything they're doing. And what's important for people to know is that we haven't given up any options.
Mm-hmm.
We can
mm-hmm.
put sanctions back on. We can take military action if we ever have reason to believe that Iran is not living up to the agreement.
Were we to put, well, this is so conditional, but were we to put sanctions back on, would the Europeans be with us? What are the conditions under which they would resume sanctions?
The Europeans will not be with us if we rip up this deal, and they've made that very clear to the president and to the United States Congress. They believe it's working. The International Atomic Energy Agency has now issued 9 reports. And all of them say that Iran is complying with all the terms of the agreement. So the Europeans and, of course, the Russians and Chinese, who were also part of this, do not believe there's any basis for ripping up the agreement. Clearly, if Iran doesn't comply, then we would see a lot of people on board to snap back the sanctions.
So you said that we had the military capability to at least take out what existed of the program and opted out of that. Something else was going on as well, however, though. There were cyber attacks from somewhere that involved bringing, you know, the sudden...
The New York Times said.
The sudden spinning of centrifuges were cyber attacks. In any case, President Obama's preferred option when it came to taking that kind of action.
Well, as you can imagine, I'm not going to comment on things that were done in any classified setting. All I can say is the New York Times reported on what is known as the Stuxnet cyber attack that was done on Iran. I think cyber is a very serious and difficult issue. I think it's going to be very much part of our lives forever now. I think all countries have to be very careful about using it as a weapon of war, because once you put something into the system, it can come back and get you. I think the debate, which California is very well aware of, and Silicon Valley certainly is that we have to think about how to protect individuals, companies, countries, both in civilian times and times of war. The Geneva Conventions cover wartime. I think a lot of companies are looking at, a lot of people are looking at, how to protect civilians, how to ensure internet freedom, internet privacy, and at the same time make sure that people can't, or countries can't, steal trade secrets, can't steal companies' informations, and as we just experienced in our election, can't affect the outcome of a democratic election. Very serious.
We're one of the most information-dependent countries in the world, when you think about it. So while we have a tremendous advantage over most when it comes to cyber, the capability to use cyber attacks, we also in many ways are the most vulnerable. What about the physical infrastructure, the switches that power our energy grids, our communications, our transportation? Where's the is there great vulnerability there, and where's the responsibility lie? They're in private hands, aren't they?
Some of their private hands, some in public utilities. I think the responsibility lies with all of us. There are some vulnerabilities, to be sure, and you know we're entering the era of artificial intelligence. And the Internet of Things, when everything we do will be a smart product. And that increases all of this. We also do all of our computing for the most part in the cloud, which has changed everything about how we need to protect our space in the cyber world. This is a very fraught area, which needs a lot of attention, a lot of difficult thought, and artificial intelligence is coming at us very, very fast. This isn't like the Industrial Revolution, which took maybe 30 years. This is going to happen in a decade.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of sort of the early days with nuclear weapons, when we had this huge advantage. We didn't really want to put any constraints, because they would constrain us. And finally, we got smart enough to figure out that we would be vulnerable too. Now is the time to establish the norms and work out the agreements.
Absolutely.
Do you feel like the U.S. government right now is seized of the kind of urgency of doing that?
I don't think any government is. You know, with full disclosure, I'm part of the Albright-Stonebridge Group, and we work for some of the companies that are trying to look at these norms and how to move them forward. But I think we are all behind the curve.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is some leadership out there trying to move us forward, and it's quite important.
And do you see that leadership coming from the private sector?
I think we're going to see a lot more of it from the private sector, because they understand what's necessary. They want to protect their brand. They want to protect their place in the market. So I think we'll see a lot.
They probably want to do the right thing.
Absolutely, and do the right thing, yes.
So let's go to another country that you know very well, and that's North Korea, since you were part of the effort to negotiate the agreement there, the 1994 agreement. And you're taking me there only because I'm thinking about the Sony,
Sony
cyber
attacks
on Sony. With the 1994 agreed framework, what did you achieve? There's great criticism because ultimately the North Koreans, I think it was after 9 years, violated it. Is that right?
So here's the truth. First of all, I didn't negotiate the agreed framework. That was done
by Bob Gallucci,
Ambassador Bob Gallucci, a really fine diplomat.
Yeah.
And the idea there was to get North Korea to stop It's production of what could be weapons-grade plutonium and reprocessing that plutonium for weapons-grade plutonium at a facility in their country. And in return, the United States, with the help of South Korea and Japan, would build a light water reactor that could provide energy but would be more proliferation-proof. And for the entire time that Bill Clinton was president of the United States, no new fissile material was made in North Korea. No ICBMs were created. No nuclear tests took place. And we did begin to get concerned that North Korea was improving its missile capability and moving towards trying to build a delivery system for a potential nuclear weapon. And we didn't think that was very good. And so the president, President Clinton, asked Bill Perry to lead an effort that became the Perry Process to work to see what we could do about that. And I worked with Bill as the person inside government. And then when he stepped back, I took over. And towards the end of the Clinton administration, we were in the midst of negotiating a moratorium on missile testing for certain classes of missiles, particularly long-range missiles. And
then came the elections.
Right. We had made some good progress. And as you know, Madeleine Albright took a very historic trip to Pyongyang. We had very serious discussions with Kim Jong-il, the father of the current leader. We thought we were on our way to an agreement. And we had this election that never got over between Al Gore and George Bush. And at the end of the day, the president just ran out of time. Yeah. He was also trying to do Middle East peace at the same time.
I was going to say.
Yes. It's a busy, busy time. So we met with Colin Powell and Condi Rice, who were going to be coming in as Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. Colin thought that what we were doing made a lot of sense. Condi thought that President Bush would want to do a policy review. And many presidents do. He did. He decided not to proceed. The Bush administration did find out that North Korea was starting a highly enriched uranium program, very nascent, but beginning it, and it all fell apart. In retrospect, I would have urged the Bush administration to keep going anyway. We didn't do everything right in the agreed framework. North Korea thought they were going to get normalized relations. That didn't happen. So it had some flaws to it, to be sure, but it could have been built on and strengthened, and perhaps we wouldn't be where we are today.
Now, you began your career as a social worker, aren't I right?
How did
that help prepare you for these roles?
So what I say to people is that I'm still a social worker. The skills that I learned as community organizer and a clinician, and those clinical skills come in very handy with members of Congress and dictators, that my caseload has just changed. I use the same skill set. I began as the director of child welfare in the state of Maryland. I managed through very strange circumstances to move into politics, helped Barbara Mikulski become the first Democratic woman elected in her own right, and worked on presidential campaigns, and then got a call to come and meet Warren Christopher and ended up the Assistant Secretary for Legislative Affairs and then counselor of the department. Built a private business, and then came back as the undersecretary. So I've been very privileged and very lucky.
Let me take you back to North Korea and ask you, what is the significance of the most recent missile test? It appears that they have an ICBM that may be able to reach any part of the United States.
We are in a very, very difficult spot with North Korea. The North Korean issue makes the Iran deal look like child's play, quite frankly. Because North Korea has nuclear weapons, and as you note, well on its way, even if it doesn't have all the guidance and entry systems that it needs, very close to getting an intercontinental ballistic missile that can deliver them to the continental United States. So it's very tough. It's not clear to me that the administration has a fully detailed strategy using all of the tools that we have in our toolbox in a coordinated fashion with diplomacy at the center. I hope that, you know, someday I'll wake up and find out that we've had a secret channel and we've actually been having discussions with the North Koreans and the Chinese have been helping and people have tightened sanctions and missile defenses in place if necessary. And even though North Korea hasn't yet agreed to everything that needs to be agreed to, that we have started down a road. But it will be a long road and it will be a very difficult one.
Do you have a sense that the Japanese now and the South Koreans feel that we're on some shared path and a shared strategy, or is it the same confusion exist in the region?
If I'm generous, I think it's better than it was, in part because of the president's recent trip to Asia. There's nothing like showing up to say you care and you pay attention. Prime Minister Abe is very much on board, I think, with taking a very tough approach. President Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, was elected to have dialogue, not to have missile defense, not to have a tough approach. And yet he finds himself in a situation where he has to be a lot tougher than he campaigned. He has been willing to make some adjustments. The missile defense system, THAAD, is staying in place. So I give President Moon a lot of credit. The South Koreans and the Japanese do not have the strong relationship that would be best here. They have a lot of historic issues that are still not resolved, including the issue of comfort, what is known as the comfort women. So I hope that South Korea and Japan work hard at getting to a better place, because we all need to be in sync with each other going forward here.
Now, the goal has been on the part of the Trump administration to roll back the nuclear weapons program. In other words, to have a non-nuclear peninsula, a peninsula without nuclear weapons. Has that train left the station, and are now, is it much more realistic to think in terms of arms control as opposed to disarmament, and perhaps a freeze as opposed to rolling back?
Well, I believe that we should maintain denuclearization as the objective, but there will probably be some interim steps on the way. And I think denuclearization of North Korea and of the Korean Peninsula should remain the objective. Otherwise, we're sending a signal to South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Saudi Arabia, countries around the world, it's okay to go get nuclear weapons. So I think denuclearization should stay the objective, but some of the things that you suggest may indeed be interim steps along the way.
Yeah. And as you think about his motivation, Kim Jong-un's motivation, does this stem from a real security concern, a worry that we're seeking or others would seek regime change in North Korea were it not for nuclear weapons? Or is he just looking for some respect? What are his objectives?
I think you've hit the core one, which is that he believes, and it has been the narrative since his grandfather took over control of the country after the Korean War, which ended in an armistice, not a peace treaty. Kim Jong-un believes that the United States is an existential threat to the regime and to the country of North Korea. And the only way to deter us is to have nuclear weapons. And back when I went to North Korea during the Clinton years, they were talking about Saddam Hussein not having a nuclear weapon. And imagine if he'd had a nuclear weapon, he wouldn't find himself in the place that he was in. They talked about Ceausescu in Romania. He wouldn't have fallen if he'd had nuclear weapons. So this is an old saw that continues to sing, to mix my metaphors here, in North Korea. I also believe that Kim Jong-un believes that the North won the Korean War, that there ought to be reunification, that reunification should come under North Korea's domain. So there's a lot riding on the future of the country. But first and foremost, this is about seeing the United States as an existential threat to him and to his country.
So what would it cost us to in fact, move beyond armistice to a peace treaty, to a formal end to the Korean War? And what would it cost us to maybe pull back on some of our military exercises? It seems like those are two objectives on his side. If you actually got a stop to the nuclear weapons program and to the missile program and, you know, inspectors in there, would that be worth it? Would that be enough to get it, number one? And what would it cost us to make that trade?
Well, I think that those are potential elements. We certainly have to keep up our military readiness, but there are a lot of ways to do that. How many troops, where you train, how you train, some of those elements can shift, I believe. But we can't undermine our readiness under the current circumstances. Peace treaty is something they've always wanted. That certainly is something that could come under discussion. But, you know, all of this has to be sequenced and part of an overall strategy and approach. I have no doubt that when the day comes, and as I said, I hope it's secretly already happened, that we sit down with North Korea, they undoubtedly will start with a very hard line, and we will start with a very hard line, and then we'll begin. That's how negotiations happen. And I was in Moscow about 2 months ago at a non-proliferation conference, and the North Koreans, very unusual, sent a delegation headed up by Madam Che, who really is their external voice. She sat on two panels. Her deputy sat on a panel. Very unusual. And she was very tough, very hard line. But to my ears, it was the opening salvo in framing the opening position of a dialogue.
As you look back at your years in the Clinton administration, there are some who say, "Gee, the fact both under the fact that the Libyans got rid of their nuclear weapons, that and that then later we did go for regime change. I mean, originally it was responsibility to protect, but ultimately it was regime change in Libya. Is this so that there are things that happened elsewhere in the world that may have felt like they made sense in their own right that is signaling to the North Koreans, oh, we better not deal. We better keep those weapons."
Well, they look at all of these things, and quite frankly, to go back to our earlier discussion, if President Trump does rip up the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, North Korea will say, well, heck, why should we sit down with the Americans? They're not trustworthy. Iran is doing everything they said they were going to do, and the Americans still walk away. So, yes, they watch everything. They don't always get it right. They don't always interpret what we do and what the rest of the world is doing correctly because, you know, Kim Jong-un really hasn't traveled outside of his country. He once did, but not since he's become leader as a child, not as a leader of his country. And so he lives in really more of a cult than a country. And so he doesn't always get it right. But sure, of course, all of these things feed in to a narrative they've already constructed.
Right, right. And then as you look back, are there any places where you'd love to have a do-over? I mean, not you personally, but our approach to Syria, for example.
Sure.
Was there maybe an early opportunity to intervene and prevent the kind of horror we've seen since? Or was there never such an opportunity?
Well, you know, President Obama and all of us, I think, we always learn the last lesson a little too well. Mm. We learned the lesson of the Vietnam War for quite some time afterwards, and we're hesitant to ever intervene or to get engaged in with forces abroad. Then we did with Iraq, and we sort of learned again, you know, we better be careful what we do because we might have been good on the first day of shock and awe, but we weren't very good over the long term, and we aren't very good at regime change. And we really didn't have all the planning in place that was necessary. Libya was a humanitarian disaster that the Europeans engaged in and we supported, but all of the forces, the civil forces, were not there for the day after. So we all have a lot of responsibility of the aftermath of some of the things that we get underway. And so President Obama was very concerned about sort of starting down the slippery slope in Syria. I've publicly said, and the president knows, that I would have taken more action early on, but I understood why President Obama did not. He was worried about the slippery slope. The American people did not support us getting engaged. We ultimately created some smart weapons so that if they fell into the wrong hands, we could stop them from being used. But early on, we didn't have all the technology we needed to help out the opposition forces who were going. There were a lot of elements. We knew that some people were getting engaged in Syria as proxies, and did we want to find ourselves in the middle of a proxy war? So I understood why President Obama was hesitant. I do believe there was an alternative early on, but, you know, he was the president of the United States, had access to much more information even than I did, and he had a responsibility. I didn't have it. So it's easy for us who sat there and said we should do more, because we didn't have to ultimately bear the burden of the responsibility of the decision he had to make. I do feel good that we got out all the declared weapons in Syria. I am deeply devastated that Assad kept either some precursors or some actual weapons hidden away, and that he once again attacked his people with chemical weapons. But that doesn't mean the chemical weapons agreement that we reached was bad. It got out all of the declared chemicals, and that was quite extraordinary.
Yeah. Ambassador Sherman, thank you so much for taking this time with us. Next time we talk, I'm going to want to pick up on a couple of threads, and that is your reference to the role of the private sector and big issues like cyber, but also the humanitarian, the nonprofit sector mm-hmm. that's playing such a large role in these humanitarian crises. So next time we'll talk about, we'll get out of government and into those other two sectors. But thank you so much for spending this time.
Thank you, Jane. I look forward to it.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We just heard from Wendy Sherman. She's the former Undersecretary of State and led the effort to negotiate the Iran nuclear weapons deal. We're now turning to Orville Schell of the Asia Society in New York and Philip Yoon, who's Executive Director and CEO of the Plowshares Fund. So, Philip, let's start with you. North Korea has tested intercontinental ballistic missiles that are believed to be able to reach the continental United States. There's now a report from the Defense Intelligence Agency that they may have miniaturized nuclear warheads so they can put those on ICBMs. Did this all take us by surprise?
It sounds like from the media it did, but for some time now, people have saying that the North Koreans strategically have been working towards this particular goal for quite some time now. And if you have seen what they've been doing in terms of their missile testing program over the last 15 to 20 years, a lot of this should not come as a surprise. Just as some historical context, the grandfather, Kim Il-sung, did something like 15 tests. And then during his lifetime. And then we had for something like 17 years, the father, Kim Jong-il, did something like 46 tests. But a lot of those were short-range missiles, which they were quite competent at doing. And it was really sort of testing signals to the United States about what they can do. But in terms of the longer-range missiles, not a whole lot. And then during the grandson, Kim Jong-un, since he's been in power now something like 6 years, I think the calculation was something like 96 tests yeah. of all different iterations. And then you coincide that with the other piece of this, which is them testing their nuclear weapons and actually doing two tests last year. It's a bad combination, and it's one in which I think over the medium to longer term, if we don't figure out a way to address this issue, North Korea at some point in the future, 4 years, 5 years, who knows exactly, will have a small nuclear arsenal that is capable of hitting the United States. I think that that's something that most people agree on. Some people disagree whether they have that capability actually now, and we can talk about that later.
Now, it's known that former President Obama told the incoming President Trump that North Korea would be his first test. Say something about why you believe Kim has chosen to demonstrate this capability now and to flaunt this capability now. Is there any particular meaning as to why he's doing this or understanding as to why he's doing this?
I believe so. There are two things. One is that we know that the North Koreans do not like these military exercises that happen between the United States and South Korea annually. They do some in the wintertime and they do some in the summer. There are, in fact, exercises going on right now. The really big one that's happening is usually around the March-April timeframe. And the North Koreans have signaled that they very much didn't want that to happen. So we knew that there was going to be, and then we know as a result of the two nuclear tests that happened, we were going to be making sure that these war exercises were more robust than ever. And we were going to be telegraphing to the North Koreans that the deterrence aspect of, that they can't intimidate us. So there was a recipe there that we knew something was going to happen. There's another aspect that's going on here. I think that tactically the North Koreans are doing something. They'll do something for internal reasons. It somehow bolsters their particular Kim Jong-il's position within the regime. There's also the second part is that there's a military necessity. As we were talking about before, I think North Korea are trying to get a nuclear device that's mated with a weapon. But there's another aspect, which is external, and this is testing. Now, one testing is the normal testing, a nuclear test, a missile test, but there's another kind of test going on right now. This is a whole new administration. So Kim Jong-un and their regime have a history of testing what a new set of policymakers are going to do. So here's a perfect opportunity for them to prod, explore, and push to see how far they can push. Now, the problem is that with Kim Jong-il, we knew a lot how far he would go. Kim Jong-un, we don't. And then you had Donald Trump, who is known to be aggressive, push back, and unpredictable, kind of like Kim Jong-un. So that's a bad mix and some room for miscalculation. So that's sort of the psychology that's going on here right now.
And it sounds like, though, that both sides were testing the other, or at least trying to send a signal to the other, and certainly in our proceeding with the exercise.
Exactly. And the way I look at it is that if you look at what happened in the March-April timeframe, we thought they were going to do another nuclear test, and the most recent sort of tension that occurred, they're very similar. You had basically a ratchet. You had North Korea doing provocative behavior that it instituted, that it instigated. Then you had an exchange of harsh rhetoric. Now, Donald Trump's tweets were the new element of all this. Then you had the media breathless about how war was imminent. And then suddenly there was a puncture of the balloon where, in fact, North Korea didn't do anything. This was in April, and there was just a parade. And then basically about a week ago, Kim Jong-un basically said, I'm not really going to do anything about Guam, because he talked about shooting this around Guam. There's an issue about translation. And he said, I'm going to wait and see. So suddenly all the tension has gone out. And what we have here is round one, which was in April. This is round two of what I think is going to be a multi-round testing and pushing by the North Koreans on the United States and allies to see what they're going to do. So I think we can expect more later.
Let's talk about round two for a minute. The president talked about fire and fury raining down on the North. He also said that, gee, if you go ahead and keep threatening us, or if you launch missiles toward Guam, our military is locked and ready. I want to understand what locked and ready means. Was there any change in the way we deployed our capabilities? Was there anything that put us on signaled a wartime footing? Or was this rhetoric without any of the kinds of activities one would expect to go with planning for war?
Well, I think what we were doing, which did make sense, was we were enhancing our deterrence capability. And so we were doing the things that we need to do with the missile defense system, THAAD. We sort of were trying to show solidarity with our allies. But in terms of what was going on the ground, not a lot has changed. And one of the things, there are a lot of indicators. Like, for example, there was no non-combatant evacuation. I mean, if we were going to do something, in effect, what would happen was we would clear out all of the American dependents. That's not going to happen.
We'd get people out of Seoul. You'd get people out of the bases in Guam.
Exactly. And our war setting hadn't changed in that sense, our DEFCOM or whatever the alert systems that we use. There are a lot of other indicators. And I think we were very careful, quite frankly, to show the North Koreans that we weren't going to be doing that actually on the military side. So to answer your question, yes, it was a lot of rhetoric. And it's not helpful because in a lot of ways, it's not really that credible. And to show you about the North Korean side, when all this heated rhetoric was going on during, what was it, the 9th and the 14th, if you looked at what was going on in North Korea, from my understanding, it was business as usual. There was no heightened alert. Everyone was sort of doing their own thing and living their own lives. So there is the sense that they weren't really taking it seriously either. And then that opens up a whole can of worms as to credibility and what effect these tweets actually do.
But Orville, what it also does is open up the possibility for diplomacy. And surely these were signals that they, or this was a lack of signals that the Chinese read and probably read pretty accurately. The Chinese have said, and I think Russia has said also, that there was or perhaps is a deal to be made. And that is that perhaps the North Koreans would at least put a pause on their missile testing, but maybe even freeze their nuclear development in exchange for our putting a pause on or ending our military exercises, the joint exercises that we do annually that Philip referred to. We seem to have rebuffed them on that. What is their reaction?
That offer is certainly on the table, and the Chinese are always trying to get the United States to talk rather than threaten. But China's also, over the last 5 years, come a long, long way to recognizing that North Korea is a threat. And curiously, even though they are not always on the same page with Washington, I think there has developed a demonstrable common interest now between the U.S. and China. And we saw that manifested itself quite clearly in the last round of U.N. sanctions when China voted for them, as did Russia. It's not unthinkable But it would take some really innovative, risk-taking type of thinking that Trump, if he can exercise the thing he says he's really good at, namely deal-making, could make a deal with Xi. I mean, think about it for a minute. China's not happy about a nuclear North Korea. They recognize that if we have a dust-up, it's they're the ones who are going to really suffer. They would like to see this resolved. And if, in fact, they could make a deal, they would also accomplish the other great thing that President Xi in China would like to accomplish, namely what he calls a new kind of big power relationship with the U.S. In other words, a kind of a G2. The U.S. and China get together, sort of like two, you know, mafia capos, and they divide up the territory and they make some deals. Now, if they could do that, and it's still possible, I think China would walk away basically with the store. Trump has already said that if he got a deal on North Korea, he'd lighten up on trade, which is a big, you know, sort of a troublesome, unresolved issue in the offing. I think also he'd be very much inclined to make concessions in the South China Sea.
Well, that would be very interesting.
It'd be very interesting for China.
Yeah.
Now, should he do it? That's another question. I think on Taiwan, he might be a little less willing to support the Taiwan government. So I think one can imagine that if China can jump over its own shadow and trust Trump enough to make some kind of a deal, it could really be advantageous for both sides. But unfortunately, we are locked into a lot of sort of common wisdom and long period of distrust and paranoia. So it isn't a foregone conclusion that they will be able to do this.
You know, Orville is absolutely right. And he alludes to this sort of larger picture between the U.S. and China, that relationship, which China is really focusing on. They, United States and China have a common goal related to the, you know, a non-nuclear Korean Peninsula. But the problem is that their priorities differ. Our big priority happens to be denuclearization and nonproliferation. Theirs happens to be one more of stability. Another question or another issue is the future of U.S. troops in Korea.
We've got, what, 28,000?
28,500. You've got 50,000 in Japan. You know, what happens if there is a change of status quo on the Korean Peninsula? I mean, the Chinese fought on the side of the North Koreans in the Korean War, had something like 600,000 casualties. And so for them to give that up without it having any assurances, and that was to prevent the U.S. from having potential of having troops along the Yalu River along China, all of that would have been in vain unless they get some kind of strategic understanding of where they need to be. And that's something that no one really wants to talk about, and they have to.
Particularly the Chinese.
Particularly the Chinese.
If we start talking about what if there is regime change,
yes,
what will the U.S. do, that's a topic the Chinese really want to know the answer to, but they do not want to raise the question because they're very neuralgic about anyone interfering in anybody's internal affairs. And they don't want to seem to be on the side of regime change anywhere because they figure they could very easily become the brunt of such an effort. But, you know, I think another thing we haven't spoken of that the U.S. could put on the table and should put on the table is, you know, we forget we have an armistice for the Korean War. There's no treaty.
Yeah.
Now, we could offer a final settlement of the Korean War, which would give Pyongyang, North Korea, Kim Jong-un, some standing.
Yes, some legitimacy.
Yep. So that is something that is sort of long overdue. China would like to see that happen. It would be something I think the U.S. could do if they get around to recognizing that the North Korean regime is probably here to stay for a while, that regime change is probably not in the offing, and if it was, it would be a mess, and to try to sort of ratify the status quo by putting some boundaries on it and controlling the nuclear situation, and to do that with China, mm-hmm, if possible. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We'd have a tremendous amount of ripple effects from that, and of course, China would gain enormous stature if they could sort of break through their normal distrust and paranoia about U.S. intentions.
Mm-hmm. Now, what we know China does not want is the collapse of North Korea. Right? This is back to your point, Philip, about stability, is the fear that you'd have 20 million or so impoverished, hungry refugees flowing over the border. Do we understand that well enough? Do we understand what the risks are to China? And do we acknowledge those as we're pushing China on increased sanctions?
These are the kinds of things, if you have decent relationships with a country, as we should have with China, we ought to be able to discuss quietly and secretly. You know, what are the protocols for eventuality X, eventuality Y, no U.S. troops north of the 38th parallel, the U.N. might control the Yalu River to keep refugees out. There are many, many things that could be discussed if the Chinese could gain a level of comfort. And the problem here is that Trump is not a kind of guy that engenders a lot of comfort, a lot of the Chinese thinking they'll be able to read him because he's so unpredictable.
Yes, and quietly and secretly is not has not been the
not style his MO.
Of this White House. Philip.
The deal here, though, and if there's going to be a deal or accommodation, we have to step back and think about why North Korea wants nuclear weapons and the missiles to deliver them. And so strategically, the way I describe it is that they ultimately, this regime, and most people can agree, the overlying objective is regime survival. The way I've looked at it, and reasonable people can disagree, but why I look at it, to operationalize that, there are three elements. One is to protect North Korea from intimidation and attack, protect the homeland. Second one is to preserve the sort of national myth that this particular regime in North Korea has cultivated, this cult. And then the third is an economic thing, which Kim Jong-un actually has put in place when it was his first public speech. He talked about economics being very, very important. Now, if you think about those three things, security, legitimacy, and economic benefits, those are the three things that they've been fairly consistent about. And nuclear weapons provides all three of those. Nuclear weapons gives you security. It's a cheap man's sort of device. When I was in negotiations with North Koreans, they said if Milosevic had a nuclear weapon and if Saddam Hussein had a nuclear weapon, they'd still be in power. Yeah. And then subsequently, if Gaddafi had nuclear weapons, he'd still be in power. So that's the way they look at it. The second thing is that there are very few nuclear powers in the world. North Korea says we're one of them. That's what they say. And de facto, they are. And South Korea doesn't have them. So there's a propaganda value. And the fact that they put so much literally blood, sweat, and tears and money into the system, they attached a prestige to it that is incredibly important that we have to recognize. And then finally, I believe this regime has recognized that in order for them to prosper, for them to turn around the economy, and I do believe Kim Jong-un is on the hook for this. It may not be right now. He has to improve the economy, and the economy has slowly improved from a very low base. The deal then has to address all three of those things with pressure. Good cop, bad cop. China's playing the good cop. The United States, South Korea, and Japan on one hand are playing bad cop. That works really well if you're coordinated. But right now, they are not coordinated whatsoever. And what has to happen is that China has to be willing to use harsher sticks, and the United States has to be willing to use much sweeter carrots.
Start with that first one, which is regime survival. From Kim Jong-un's perspective, these exercises and other things that have either been done or said are indications to him, if I understand this correctly, that we might invade and overthrow him, that is an ultimate goal of ours. What can be done by way of confidence-building measures to reassure on that score?
Well, I think over the short term, there are ways to structure a lot of these exercises in order to show them that these are defensive and not offensive. So there are simple things as offering them to come and observe, or the Chinese or a third party to observe these exercises, so they don't feel like, you know, there's some transparency here. The other thing is as simple as announcing, this is what we're going to do, and these are how our troops are going to be moving, so the North Koreans don't get surprised. It's all about an element of surprise. So, for example, when we're doing our B-1B bombing runs, which the North Koreans absolutely hate, if it's prelude to an invasion, you want to make sure that there's no huge troop movements accompanying those kinds of things. Or if there's going to be an invasion, there are things like logistics, fuel, making sure that those things are not happening. And I think the military is very careful about doing those kinds of things. There are, of course, other things where we can be proactive, or we'll just talked about the peace treaty. We could do more and more people-to-people exchanges, which are being clamped down on. I mean, Orville and I were working on some of these exchanges. Those kinds of things can build confidence in many ways. So the bottom line is that our policy over the last 20 years, 15 years or so has failed. And doing the same old thing is not going to work. So we've got to use fresh thinking, I mean, it's easy to say, hard to do, but there are some really interesting ideas there that we need to start thinking about if we're going to try to get out of this box we're in right now.
So Orville, Philip referred to China being able to carry a bigger stick or have more disincentives for North Korea. Can they go much farther? They've cut off the coal imports. That's a big deal, isn't it, from North Korea's standpoint? I don't know how it's affecting the Chinese economy, but can they afford to go further?
They could. Now, I mean, think about it. If we could come to some agreement with China that we would entertain a next phase of sanctions, what would they be? Well, first of all, they'd cut off the oil pipeline to the north, which Pyongyang is utterly dependent on. Second of all, 90% of all North Korea's trade goes through China and their rail lines across the Yalu River. They could shut down the rail lines. Third, there are the Air China and Air Korea from North Korea fly to Beijing. That's really the only way to get into North Korea from the outside world except from Vladivostok. They could close that down. So there are a lot more things they could do if they wanted to. And I think the question is, do they have a high enough level of confidence that they would gain enough? In other words, would they win in other parts of the board if they did this with the United States? Would the United States under President Trump be a trustworthy ally? China could also lean on the Russians. There are Russian technicians who've been in there, and that's why we see these ICBM tests are much more advanced, and their engines coming from the Ukraine, which is basically a company that had been set up when the Ukraine was part of Russia. So there are a lot of things that China could do, but you have to reassure China, and they have to be able to feel comfortable that their interests would be well served by doing these things. Then I think Korea would have maximum incentives to yield in whatever ways they're going to yield. And then we would have to have some carrots. And I think the carrots are, well, you push China, you squeeze North Korea, and then you open the door to both of them by offering these things, like whether it's a peace treaty, whether it's you accept North Korea as a nuclear power and you have a freeze in development, things of that nature. But it is possible. But it is certainly not a foregone conclusion that this is going to happen, because we have many decades of sort of intractable hostilities here to overcome.
And accepting it as a nuclear power. I mean, an interesting thing that President Trump said when he referred to fire and fury, he said this isn't what a normal power does regarding North Korea.
It's what Pakistan did. It's what India did, and we accepted them.
Yeah, but my point being that I thought it was an interesting choice of words, because normal came straight out of the State Department. That doesn't come out of his normal lexicon. You know, a little more of an understanding that being treated as a normal power is what North Korea wants, and letting them know, well, this isn't the way you're going to get it. Can we, would we accept it as a nuclear power and say, look, what we want to do is just freeze it now and then start arms control and disarmament talks? But first, yes, this is the baseline. We understand that.
I think we're not quite at that point where we have to say that. And I think the next round really should be between the U.S. and China, where we assay China's ability to possibly put another round of sanctions on the table. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to turn North Korea, because I think actually Kim Jong-un is not an irrational man.
Yeah.
He's a very rational man. And as you've suggested, he said he understands his survival depends on having a bomb, and he's not going to let it go. Mm-hmm. So if that's the reality and you can't get rid of it, you may not like it. But then any realistic person has to think, okay, what's plan B?
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can reach us at worldaffairs.org. In the first half hour of this program, we heard from Wendy Sherman. She was Undersecretary of State during the Obama administration. We then heard from Orville Schell of the Asia Society and Philip Yoon of the Plowshares Fund. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.